what might archaeology tell us, what might history tell us, but how to be fearless, how to be courageous. There was a message given to a group of people who were not particularly fearless in one of the most difficult and challenging circumstances, and it literally turned the world upside down. That's exactly what Jesus accomplished. He took a group of mostly Hebrew boys and maybe one man in Peter from a simple little village in Israel, and he took them to a Greek-Roman city, a place known for temptation and chaos, a place called Caesarea Philippi. When you walk up to the remains of that today, you will see a ginormous cave known as the Gates to the Underworld. The Gates of Hades, it was called. He brought his Hebrew young men to this place, and it's here he told them that they were going to be part of something amazing. This was going to be a clash of the titans, the Hebrew God versus the Greek gods. He was going to show people how to live differently, that he would come and defeat death once and for all. In fact, I got a chance to visit this location twice in the last 10 years. It was not just a battleground then. When I visited last time, there were literal missiles flying over our head. We had to rush back on the bus. What happened back then that's led to what's happening now? What does archaeology tell us about how to be courageous in the most unusual place? If we go back to 300 BC, we can date this place based on coins and olive pits. And we have found that this place was originally called Panias, after the Greek god Pan. If you've ever seen him before, he's half man and half goat. That becomes important because when we catch up to Jesus' time, there is unbelievable worship going on of Pan. And it's from Pan's name we get words like panic and pandemonium. That's exactly what it looked like. It was a crazy fertility ritual, very much like the red light district going on right there in front of everyone. Now, the place is beautiful. Yes, there's a cave, but there's also waterfalls and there's also springs. But right next to the cave, it was known as the gateway, not only to Hades, but also the gateway to Pan. There was a massive temple set up there. And it was here people would make thunderous, almost chaotic noises as they worshiped fertility gods and gave themselves to everybody sexually in a way that was just a place that Hebrew boys and religious people didn't find themselves. So why would Jesus bring his disciples here to witness these almost satanic rituals, something you might see in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? Imagine this. I've stood on this rock. Jesus walks in with his disciples, walks up on a rock as they're watching this temple worship, all this chaos, people lost, giving themselves over to anything but God. He says to them, I got two questions for you. Number one, who do people say I am? Peter looks up and says, I think you're more than a prophet. I think you're more than a teacher. I think you're the Son of God. And Jesus says, that's exactly right. Now let me tell you my mission. Upon this rock, this place, and it's filled with rocks there, Caesarea Philippi. He points down at the rock where this temple is built, where people are involved in all kinds of chaotic things. Upon this rock, I will build my church. It's in the most chaotic, painful, lost moments, darkest places in life. I want you, my disciples, my followers, to go and share hope and life, and do it in a fearless way. Today, in Raiders of the Lost Cities, we're going to find out how these 12 men changed the world by understanding Jesus claimed to be God on earth, and two, he could make a difference in anyone's life. We found it in Caesarea Philippi.
Good morning. My name is Beth Guckenberger, and if I haven't met you yet, it's my joy to be here. I've been coming around this community for about 15 years, and if I have met you, then I want to say hi to you afterwards. I look forward to seeing you. Well, I think this is an amazing series. Two of those times that Chad had a chance to be at Caesarea Philippi, I was there with him. We had that experience on that rock together. I can certainly picture what he's talking about, but I want to zoom out for a minute and just say, why did even Jesus go there? Like, what? It's definitely a real place, and it definitely is all the things that Chad just told us about, but like, what would make him go there? for almost 80% of the 3 years we have recorded of Jesus' activities during what we call the 3 years of ministry, 80% of his activity happened in a little 12-mile triangle. And Caesarea Philippi is 25 miles away from that triangle. So he went on a very purposeful field trip. And he took those boys, most of them from that fishing village. He just mentioned those disciples, except for Peter, who was a man. But he took those young Hebrew men on a 25-mile pedestrian field trip. And I don't know, I have a bunch of kids. And I don't know if you've ever been on a field trip with, young teenage boys. But I got to believe at like mile 10 and 12 and 15 and 18 and 21 and 22 and 23 and 24, they were asking, are we there yet? What could possibly be so important that we have to go there? But Jesus knew this story in Matthew 16 happens at almost the end of his 3-year ministry. And so he's already said all kinds of things to them. He's already shown all kinds of things to them. He's preparing them because he knows that he's going to leave. So what do they need? What do they have left that they need to know? It's almost like what we're going to read here in the passage is like his graduation speech. It's like, I have a son who's about to graduate from college, and he's going to get married. And I don't know if you've ever been in that situation before, but it's like even though this is my youngest child and I've done this before, I still think, like, what if I never talk to him again? I need to make sure right now he knows everything he ever needs to know. You know, like, I'm literally just smothering the heck out of him. Like, hey, listen, you need to make sure you find your people. You need to remember who you are. You need to remember to call your mother. You know, like, all the things. Like, I have my own version of a, like, what if these are some of the last words you experience in my presence? What do I want to make sure I say to him? This is the passage we're going to read today. Jesus took them on this field trip to tell them some of the things that he wanted them to know. And Chad was right. It is a physical rock. And people did do all kinds of really pretty perverse activity as they worshiped that fertility god Pan. And they worshiped the fertility god in that area because once a year, every spring, until about 200 years ago when an earthquake came and cut it off, but for thousands of years, water would come out of that cave once a year and fertilize all of the land around it. And in an effort to try to get the gods to come back and fertilize again and get their farmlands prepared, they would behave in these really grotesque and obscene ways, literally knocking on what they called the door of that cave, the gates of hell, the gates of Hades. Like, and they believe the way they could get the fertility god's attention is through doing fertility kind of activities themselves. So Jesus says in verse 13, when Jesus came to this region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, is? And he was doing what rabbis did. They asked good questions. He was asking, in a place like this, something that you've never seen before, I brought you here to specifically see it. Who do you say that I am? And, you know, they're trying to pass class. So here's what they said. They say, some people think that you're John the Baptist. Some people say you're Elijah. Others say Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And those are good answers because those men whom they named were national reformers, they were miracle workers, they were prophets, they were people that spoke the very words of God. Those are great guesses because those are behaviors with which Jesus had been demonstrating in those 3 years. And then he says to them, but who do you say that I am? Here in this place, and it's the same question he's asking us. He wants to know, this is what we're exploring today, who do you say that I am? Because we have our own kind of pandemonium around you. Chad told you that the worship of that fertility god Pan and the kind of chaotic nature of it is where we get the word pandemonium or panic. We got all kinds of pandemonium going around us. This week I sat with a family who had a devastating car accident. Their life will probably never be the same. I have a brother-in-law who's dying today probably. That family's life will never be the same. There are all kinds of stories we carried in here with us, stories that we don't like and we can't control, our own versions of things that are kind of spinning out of our control. The question is, who is God in the midst of it, and what does it matter? Is understanding who he is and who he is to me, can that orient me in an environment that might be disorienting? Well, Simon Peter answers and says, you're Christ. You're the Son of the living God. And that's a good answer, by the way. That's that he's trying to understand who God is, because once we understand who God is, we have a better understanding of who we are. Like, I need to know who God is, because if I want to be one of his kids, I need to know what that means. I have a large family, some of whom have been formed through adoption. And when you graft a branch into your tree, you are educating that child. This is what it means to be, in my case, a Gukenberger. This is what sports teams we cheer for. This is what foods we eat. This is what we put on our pizza. This is the jokes that we think are funny. This is how we eat our meals. This is where we vacation. This is what it means to be one of us. Jesus is trying to tell his disciples, you're my kid, and you're going to go out one day into a world, and you're going to carry me with you, and I want you to know not only who you are, but where it is that you come from. Who am I? One of our sons, we adopted when he was 12, and I bought him a bunch of cool clothes the first year he lived in the United States. He wore none of them. The only clothes he ever wanted to wear were the hand-me-down sports jerseys and spirit wear and t-shirts of his older brothers that bore our last name. He wanted everyone to know every single day of that first year that he belonged to our family. This is this idea, like, if we're going to be part of God's family, we need to know, what does that mean? Who is God? Where has he come from? And the community, we need to know where he is, not just when we're sitting in church and everything feels kind of nice. We need to know who he is in environments that we stumble upon that are our modern day versions of what it was that they were looking at in that day. Because we live in Caesarea Philippi today. We got all kinds of pandemonium going on today. I watched the news as I was getting ready this morning. We have all kinds of hot spots all around the world today. If you've been paying attention to our country, we got some pandemonium going on in our country today. If you've been listening to what's going on here in our city, we got some panic happening right now here in our city. And that doesn't even count whatever's happening in your own little unique world. It's a big deal. Because when you get to be one of God's kids, there's some rights and privileges that come with it. One of the things that he told us a couple of chapters before this in the Bible is that when you are one of my kids, you get to carry my light with you. You are actually, you're a light bringer, you're a light bearer. You bring light everywhere you go. And this is not a unique message to the times of Jesus. He's been telling us this all the way since the beginning of the book. One of the first stories in our Bibles is the story of in Exodus, well, that's the second book of our Bible, so maybe not the very beginning, but it's the second book out of 66. It feels like it's kind of in the beginning. In that book, they talk about how there's a story where all of the nation of God, all of his children were enslaved by Pharaoh in Egypt. And to get Pharaoh's attention, God brought all these plagues into the land. And one of those plagues was called the plague of darkness. And it says in our Bibles that darkness fell so thick on the land, they could feel it. And I got to think that's probably what it felt like for those guys to come upon Caesarea Philippi, that darkness was so thick in their land they could feel it. I don't know if you have ever been in a moment of a conflict with a person that was important to you, a piece of geography, like even go back to your brains to COVID. Sometimes it felt like darkness was so thick on our land we could feel it. But that passage in Exodus goes on to say that everywhere that God's children walked, light was among them. And I think our Bibles are supposed to be pictured, so I just want you to picture like little human lightning bugs. Like, I don't know what that meant, but it just meant that everywhere they went, light didn't overcome them. The light overcame the darkness. This is this picture that Jesus is trying to give these disciples. No matter where you go and how dark it seems, you will get to carry light with you. Jesus answers Peter, and he says, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say that you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Like Chad was saying in that video, Jesus was doing what he had been doing for a long time. Throughout the last 3 years of his teaching ministry, wherever he was, he would use the props around him to illustrate his point. So when he was in a field, he'd talk about mustard seeds and lilies of the field. And when he was near water, he talked about waves and storms. And when he was in a town that manufactured millstones, he talked about millstones. Wherever he was, he used his environment in order to illustrate complex ideas in ways that felt concrete so we could understand them. And so what if
as Chad was suggesting, that Jesus was telling Peter, I'm going to build a church, and I'm going to build it here on this rock. Because honestly, Christians have debated this verse for a really long time. Like, does this verse mean that Peter himself is the rock? You, Peter, are the rock? Like, is the disciple the rock, maybe? Or is it the confession of what Peter said? Is it the truth that Peter was saying? That's the rock on which the church was going to build. Really, honestly, both those answers ignore the cultural setting of Caesarea Philippi. I think, like Chad does, Jesus was like, hey, guess what? I brought you out here so I can show you even in the darkest corner of the earth I could find us to get to. I'm going to build my church in places exactly like this. Because Jesus knew that those disciples would one day go all around the world to all kinds of places with all kinds of darkness. And they needed to know we don't look at darkness and go, I mean, I got to get out of here. This is a mess. That's called judgment or fear. Or we don't come upon darkness and go, that looks kind of fun. I think I'm going to join them. That's called temptation. Right? We don't, when we see darkness, our response as his kid is, I got to bring my light. I'm going to build my church. This is what this is going to look like. Anything can happen. There is not a heart, a place, a situation that he cannot bring his kingdom to bear in. Everywhere we go. I work with back-to-back ministries. We work with orphaned and vulnerable children around the world. I've been in all kinds of places, and I'll finish my time with a story from one of them. But last week, we gathered some of our international directors together, and one of those directors told us a story. She serves in the Dominican Republic with us, and in the city where she was living, there is a large volume of human trafficking, of sexual tourism. And we're working with the victims of that. And she was on a day off with her family, and they were queued up in line to get a food truck, to get some French fries from a food truck. And there was a Canadian man in front of them who just turned around to talk to them in English and was telling them how much he loves the DR, and he comes every year, and he participates in those activities of the night, and it's the most amazing week ever, and his heart feels so full. But the hardest thing is that when he goes back to Canada and he's flying home, he always feels really empty. And when you tell a missionary that you have a heart that feels empty, they consider that an open door. And so they began to share the good news of this gospel, that we don't have to feel empty, that God literally came to fill us, to give us hope, not just when we change our circumstances, but every day, regardless of our circumstances. This is the good news of the gospel. And so the man shared, our staff man shared it with that man, the truth of the gospel, that Jesus loved him and wanted a relationship with him and desired to come to know him. And the guy, he didn't get out of line because he still wanted his French fries, so he was kind of a captive audience, but he didn't respond to that. He just, thank you for sharing. And our staff guy said, here's my card, and if you have any questions about what I said, you can always reach out to me. So, okay, great. They ate their French fries and left. The next day, our staff family woke up to an email that man had sent them and said, your words kept sticking to me like glue all day. I couldn't get rid of them. And in fact, at night, I couldn't even fall asleep. They just kept rolling around in my mind. And finally, somewhere in the middle of the night, I cried, Uncle. And I got down on my knees and I said to God, I don't even really fully understand who you are, but I want to not feel this way any longer. I want to feel different. I want to feel like you are actually with me and not against me. And that's a beautiful missionary story, and that was very exciting, and she was sharing it, and I was getting ready to applaud. She goes, oh no, the story's not over yet, because here's what God had for me. I'm here to help the victims of the very thing that he was there to do. And God had a message for me that, you know what, I don't even want one person to be lost. I want everyone. I can go into any place, any heart, any relationship, any, and I can bring my light. This is the message of the good news of the gospel. There is not one of us who has done a single thing. There is no future version of ourselves that God will like more than the one he loves right now. He loves you exactly where you are. It says in verse 24, then Jesus said, and that implies he called, he yelled to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? And that last, that, those last little verses reminded me of this scene I had read about in the Chronicles of Narnia. I remember the C.S. Lewis books, the Chronicles of Narnia. I don't know if you saw the movies or read those books. I love them. He's brilliant. One of those books is called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And in, if you're not familiar with Narnia, there's four kids who are siblings who are definitely the cool kids. This is what this whole story anchors around, their experiences in this world called Narnia. And then they have a cousin. His name is Prince Caspian. He is definitely a cool kid. Flowy hair. It's amazing. And then they have a cousin, another cousin named Eustace. And Eustace, his name kind of already implies it, he's not a cool kid. And he wants to be like one of those, he wants to be like his cousins. He wants to be, he wants what it is that they have. And he's always kind of throwing shade on what their experiences and doubt. And he's kind of whiny and he's challenging. Anyway, they find themselves in Narnia. And Eustace separates himself from everyone else. And he wanders into a dragon cave. And he to his utter delight, the cave is full of gold. He doesn't know it's a dragon cave. He just wanders into a cave that is full of gold. And he just starts swimming in it. Like this is everything I've ever wanted. Like, this is mine, all mine. Now I can have power and independence and respect. And he's just so happy. He's so happy. Everything in his life, his good luck has changed. Now I can have everything. And he grabs a golden cuff and he slaps it on his wrist. And just thrilled with his day, he falls asleep, spread eagle over his gold treasure. But to his surprise, he wakes up and he is himself a dragon. This was a dragon's lair in a magical land called Narnia, by the way. And at first it seems amazing, like, nobody's going to be afraid of me anymore. Look how much I can fly. I can breathe fire. Like, I am amazing. But it doesn't take very long for him to realize, I don't actually want to be a dragon anymore. I like to be a boy. But he can't figure it out. He can't take off his golden cuff. It's literally stuck on an arm, now swollen underneath it. He tries to rip off his own dragon skin. He can't do it. Every time he tries to take some skin off, there's always more underneath it. He has everything he thought he ever wanted, and he's miserable. This is what this verse is talking about. You can gain the whole world and lose your soul. And then one day, in this magical land of Narnia, he encounters Aslan the lion. And Aslan the lion is the Christ figure in these books. And Aslan the lion leads him to the water. And now Eustace the dragon looks into the water and sees his own reflection and sees who he really is. And he's trying to scratch off his own skin. And it feels good to be rid of what he can get off, but there always seems to be more underneath it. And then finally, Aslan says to him, I can undress you from your dragon skin, but you're going to have to let me do it. And here's what Eustace says. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now, so I just lay flat on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep, I thought it had gone right into my heart. And then he began pulling the skin off, and it hurt worse than anything I'd ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab of a sore place, it hurts like billio, but it's fun to see it coming away. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I had done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly than the others had been. And there was I, smooth and soft as a peeled switch and smaller than I had been. And then he caught hold of me. And I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath now that I had no skin on. And he threw me into the water, and it smarted like anything, but only for a moment. And after that, it became perfectly delicious. And as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found all the pain had gone from my arm. And then he was a boy again. This is the promise that Jesus is talking to us about in this passage. He wants us to find our life, to not lose our life in the pursuit of the wrong thing. He wants us to experience the fullness of what it means to be one of his children and the riches that come with that kind of identity, to not be enticed or even intimidated by the world that's around us in a world full and a city full of false idols. Jesus asks him to commit to believing that he is the one true God and what that now means for them. He knows he's about to commission them. He's going to send them all around the world. It says, for the Son of Man will come in all of his glory with his Father and with the angels, and then he will reward each one according to his works. And he wants them to go into that dark place. And I wanted to share with you an example, a modern day example I witnessed with my own eyes of people going into a very dark, seemingly impossible place and watching Jesus bring it to life. I moved to Monterrey, Mexico in 1997 as a missionary. And the story I'm going to tell you happened in 2011. So I had lived there a long time at that point. I could speak Spanish. I knew salsa came in two colors. I had my favorite soccer team. I had been there a long time. And in 2011, the cartels had so become an issue in our city, which was 6 million people, about the size of Chicago. It had become such an issue that everything about our regular rhythms of life stopped. We stopped hosting mission teams that year. The men's night soccer leagues were all shut down. That's when you know Mexico's in trouble, when they shut down their nighttime soccer leagues. There was the taco trucks, most of them which didn't even open until 8 or 9 at night, were all closed. Nobody went out in the evening. The whole city came to a stop because we had had in 2011 1,872 assassinations as a result of the cartels. The whole city was just at a standstill. And a friend of mine, he was a pastor, had a dream one night. And he woke up and he told his wife, "I had a dream, and in this dream I was praying with some police officers." And his wife was like, "Well, that's interesting. I don't think we know any police officers, none from our church. What do you think that was about?" He said, "I don't know. And in this country, we can trust in all ways our law enforcement." That's not always the case in developing countries. Some police officers in Mexico are amazing, but not all of them are. Some of them belong really to the cartels. And so it's not even like he in his natural realm would even have known a police officer. But anyway, he said, "I had a dream. I know it's real." And he kept asking people to pray about it. "Do you know any police officers?" In fact, one day he was having lunch and he saw some officers also having lunch, and he tried to buy their lunch as a way that maybe he could go over and meet them, and they thought he was trying to bribe them, and it did not go well. So he's like, "Okay, Lord, you got to bring me an officer on your own. I'll stop trying to find one." One day at church he was preaching, and an elder came up and passed him a note that said that the building was surrounded by police and that he needed to keep everyone in. And so you don't usually need to tell a pastor they get more time. You know, he just was like, "Okay, let's keep going." And it wasn't that unusual in those days that that would happen. I could be at the mall. I could be at the grocery store. And if there was an incident somewhere outside, they would lock down that building until they could clean up whatever it is that had happened and get all their witness statements. And so the assumption was immediately that there had been some kind of incident outside the church, and this is why everything was in lockdown mode. And then a little bit later, they passed him another note that said everything was clear. He was free to let everybody go. That actually it was the security detail of the new chief of police for one of the subdivisions of our large city who happened to have been attendants at his church. So if you think of any large city, like think Chicago is probably the one that we might be most familiar with. There's all those like really large subdivisions around Chicago that in and of themselves are their own little mini cities. This church where my friend was the pastor and this new police chief belonged to a community called Guadalupe, which had a census of about 1 million people, but it's still considered like a subdivision of the larger city. Anyway, so he was all excited, like, "Okay, here's my police officer." So he called forward everybody who was new that week and began to pray for them. And he didn't know which one was the police officer because he was out of uniform, but he got to someone he felt like the Lord told him to say that your life has been spared for the season you're in right now. And that got that man's attention. And so afterwards they had a conversation and he said, "I just came here from Cancun. I'm sure you know that your police chief was murdered last week. And I just got here and just thought I'd check out your church." And so he was very excited and he said, "Hey, can I come to your church? Can I come to your police station and pray with officers? I had a dream about that once and I'd like to come do that." And he's like, "I don't really think anybody wants to pray with you." But my pastor friend's pretty persistent, and eventually he talked him into, on a Saturday morning, as the morning and night shifts were going to change, there was an overlap where they made announcements. And he said, "I'll give you 5 minutes. You can say whatever you want, invite people to pray, whatever." So the pastor went there on a Saturday morning for 5 minutes. He shared the basics of the gospel, just the good news that you too can be filled no matter where you are and what you have done. God loves you just as you are. And afterwards, I said, "How'd it go?" And he said, "Well, nobody really responded, but my heart is full because I feel like I'm doing what God wants me to do." And he asked the police chief if he could come back the next Saturday. And he said, "If you think it went so well, of course you can come back." And so he began to go every Saturday and just slowly build on. This is like July, August, September of 2011. Share biblical truths for a few minutes in the morning on Saturdays. And then one day he felt like he should bring a music person, like a worship leader, with him. And he shared his 5 minutes, and he let the worship leader from his church sing for 2 minutes, and then he spoke for three. And it, not like anybody knew those songs or even sang along with them, but that happened October, November, December. In January of 2012, at one of those Saturday mornings, during one of those worship songs, one of the officers fell over. And everybody, the first responders, right? Everybody like went to go see what was wrong with him. But truthfully, he had just become overcome, spiritually overcome. Like he didn't know what to say about what he was experiencing spiritually, and he literally fell over. And so the police chief was like, well, listen, maybe we just haven't created an environment where they have a place to express what their spiritual interest and curiosity is. So he said, why don't you come every day of the month of February, and let's teach on the biblical character of David, and let's teach him about leadership. So my friend went every day for the month of February. At the end of February, on the last day, they gave him a certificate for participating. I think it was forced, but whatever, for participating in this leadership course that he gave. And he made an announcement that everybody knew. Up until that point, for the last year, every month, somewhere between 23 and 24 officer lives were lost in the city. And on this February 28th of 2012, they made the announcement that that month, not a single officer's life was lost. And the officers were not like all like, sign me up for Bible study. But they were like, whoever you are, you keep coming. Like, we want more of what you got to have. And so on March 1st of 2012, my friend realized, I can't sustain this pace. And he got a bunch of his pastor friends together, and he passed around a calendar and said, we're going to all take turns going there every day from here on out. And I don't want you to invite them to your church. I want you to bring church there. This is what Jesus was talking about in this passage. We're going to build a church right here in this place. And throughout the spring of 2012 into the summer, things started to change in our city. And they had already sent the National Guard in, and there was articles in the paper about how there was unprecedented victory that was being experienced by the Guadalupe Police Force, which is just one subdivision of this whole city, and it was not going to the National Guard, and not everybody loved that. But by the summer of 2012, the soccer leagues were back happening again, and our tacos were being eaten in the night again. And something was actually happening in the city. And in the fall of 2012, a new mayor was elected to govern Guadalupe. And he called some of the police chief in and the pastor. And he said, listen, everybody kind of knows what you're doing over there. And one of my first political acts is I'm supposed to give the keys of the city to somebody. And I don't know who on your little council you'd like to represent what you guys have been up to, but I'd like to give the keys of the city to one of you. And my friend said, you'd like to give the keys of the city to the person that's responsible for the kind of peace that we've been experiencing in our city in the last few months? And the mayor's like, yeah, you want that? Like, and my friend goes, if you want to give credit to the person that's been bringing peace into our city, then you need to give those keys to Jesus Christ. And the mayor was like, you'd like one of my first political acts to be to give the keys of the city to Jesus Christ? And he's like, yes, that's who deserves credit. So just in case you think I'm making the whole thing up, I brought a video with me of what it looked like when the keys were given over to Jesus Christ. The video goes on for a long time. People were going crazy. And you know, at those political events, in the front row are dignitaries from the other municipalities, and they're watching the city of Guadalupe go crazy for Jesus Christ. They're like, hey, my key thing's next week. I'm giving my keys to Jesus Christ. Like, my key thing's next week. I'm giving my keys to Jesus Christ. And by the end of 2012, all the surrounding communities around the city proper had given the keys of their city over to Jesus Christ, and things were happening that I can still point to today, 13 years later. Unprecedented movement of the Spirit of God in that city. January 2013, my pastor friend got invited to speak to the police force of the city proper, 600 men and women that stood at attention on a Saturday morning when he was given 5 minutes. And afterwards, I'm like, how'd it go? He's like, I just shared the basics of the gospel. I said, anybody raise their hand? He said, no, but I'm going to wait a few months and bring a guitar with me. And in July of 2012, the governor and the mayor of our state stood on the steps of our city capitol, and they read a chapter out of the book of Isaiah, and they dedicated the entire city over into the hands of Jesus Christ. And not everybody even understood what they were looking at. The next day, our headline said, if you turn on your water and it tastes like wine, you can thank the mayor. But it got some national attention because we were a city that was full of darkness, 1,872 assassinations. And God, through the faithfulness of a few people who decided to bring the light that they carried with them into a dark place, changed the temperature in that city, and all kinds of extraordinary things happened. And that invitation is still up for us today. If you came here and you would like to explore what it looks like to go to places, to serve in the ways that Drew offered to you, out in the atrium, we have a serving fair today. You can go out there and see all kinds of ministries, people who are doing extraordinary things in all kinds of places who would love to tell you about what it looks like for you to come and join as they're bringing light into dark places. I'm going to close this in prayer, and I just want to bring us back to that imagery of that dragon skin, that sometimes we can chase and go after that which we think will save our soul because we're trying to gain the whole world. And his promise to us is that he wants to free us from that which entraps us to give us a life like we could never imagine. Let's pray. Jesus, oh, I just ask you right now, would you come and find us? Wherever we are, at whatever kind of questions we bring to the table, whatever kind of doubts we have, whatever kind of circumstances we find ourselves in, would you come and find us? Would you reveal yourself to us? Would we hear very clearly your invitation to enter into your family? I thank you for the promise that there is no future version of me you would love more than the one you love right now. So Lord, we just return to you. Thanks that you love us exactly how you find us. Invite us into whatever corner of the world you want to. We love you and we trust you and we praise you. And we ask all these things in your name. Amen.